Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. I have no co-host today, Aaron, but so it's just me and you, and you're joining remote because you are sweeping bins.
Yeah, yep, it's that time of year.
I bet you wish we was doing this over at Lagodi Grain, and we could do it out in the bin, and I could be pushing or moving stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we may have to put some dust caps on the cameras, but be interesting.
Well, my counterpart, Jeff and Scott both, are down at the Southwestern Fertilizer Conference this week. And so I am winging it by myself, but that doesn't get me and you out of the question of the day. And this one here is for tailored for you and I. What would your wife say you waste the most money on?
Oh, definitely hunting.
I knew that was coming.
I'd probably be dead if she actually knew how much it costs. I mean, over the years. But I mean, here's the thing. It's like, I mean, you know what it's like with hunting stuff. You don't buy it every single day. It's just when you do, it's pretty big. Sizable investment. Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, that would definitely be that.
Yeah. I could probably be in that camp or some course equipment, but funny story. I had bought a Night Force scope for one of my bigger guns. And for those that know, that's a very nice scope, rifle scope. And, this one will get flagged now for being about rifles and scopes, but my wife had saw the box down in the gun room, and, she goes, I saw a box. I was moving a rifle scope box, and she goes, I don't think that was $18.75. And she goes, and I don't think it was $187.50. Please tell me that was not $1,000.
Yeah.
And I was like, I folded like a lawn chair. I'm going to sell something, honey. I'll sell something.
That's when you revert to me. I was like, well, the gun's only as good as its scope.
That's exactly right.
All the experts say that you got to spend as much on the scope as the gun. So it's just, but think about all the meat that's in the freezer because of this, sweetheart.
It's been.
And then my daughter usually chimes in and she's like, well, Dad, we haven't gotten one lately. I'm like, you're not helping me, sweetie. You're not helping me.
It's been about 15, 20 years ago, probably. The light was on. I was down in the office and it was like 1 or 2 in the morning and I was on the computer, you know, and that was like the only thing on. And she comes in, she goes, what are you doing? And I go, I'm in a chat room. And she goes, what? And I was like, it's about rifle scopes. And she goes, I said, this is all these guys do. It's optictstalk.com. And that's all they do is talk about rifle scopes.
Like, sweetheart, it could be way worse.
It could be way worse. But binoculars, scopes, everything. All right. Well, let's get serious. You've got a WASDE report from June that you want to bring us up to date on.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had the July one come out last week. Yeah. Last week. And so in June, you had the acreage reports. Some thought they could see that 95 million acre corn number go up a little bit. We saw a tiny revision, but it was 95.2 instead of 95.3. So that wasn't a big adjustment by any stretch of the imagination. Beans really didn't do anything either. They just kind of hung around. So the acreage report was very ho-hum at the end of June. The quarterly stocks kind of told us what we thought, really. So the quarterly stocks said that there was less corn and beans on farm this time versus last year, which was no shocker. Last year, we had an astronomical amount of corn still left on the farm across the nation. And we could feel it here even in our local area where it felt like there was still a lot of corn out on the farm. Everybody was kind of looking at each other like, when is this going to finally hit the pipeline? Because at some point, it was going to have to move or the farm level was going to have to basically dump all of their new crop and keep their old crop. And so it finally came in August. This year feels much more like a normal year where a lot of stuff moved in January, all the way through spring, which prices helped, especially looking back, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but looking back, it was definitely the right move to move stuff in more of a normal pattern. But yeah, so those two reports pretty ho-hum. Not a lot of volatility after that. It was kind of just reaffirming. Trade estimates were really close to what all those numbers came in at.
You know, when
the July. Oh, go ahead.
When the acres, when they don't move like that, I mean, it's almost like, okay, either it's dead on or they don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I have. I guess it could be one of the two, right? But it just seems like whenever they don't move, it feels like that after a spring, at least like how we experienced one, that they should have moved somewhere.
Yeah. And I think one of the highlights, you're kind of hitting on it, was it didn't move the needle as far as the markets go, but it was something to watch. And we saw it show up in the July numbers, which ended up being 2 weeks later. So July would have been the first chance for them to really adjust the yield after the acreage report. And which they didn't adjust the yield any. They stayed there. But what they did do, and what you saw in the acreage report, was there was this note about how many acres were still left to be planted, right? Because that number was a surveyed number for those acres, and it only runs up to a certain point, and then they collect the data. Well, once they stopped, they still figured there was X amount of acres to be planted. And we saw the revision in the harvested acre in the July number. So the harvested corn acreage went down 600,000 acres from where it was in June. So, you know, we're still sitting at 95.2 million acres that were planning on being planted, right? The intentions were there for 95.2. But what we're actually going to harvest now is what they're saying that we're going to harvest is 86.8. And that could be from flooding. That could be from acres that just didn't germinate. You know, whatever those circumstances would be, we lost about 600,000 because of weather or whatever that is. So that harvested acre number came down. And that may be prevent plant factored into it. If like they had the seed, they did the nitrogen up front, they did everything, but they couldn't get the corn in the ground. So we lost 600,000 acres there. You know, now these are still moving numbers. We won't know the final number for several months, but that was I hate to say glimmer of hope, because that meant people didn't get stuff in the ground didn't have. Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but as far as market direction, if somebody wanted to, you know, like we look out our back door, right, and we see these little drowned out spots, and we saw us getting a delayed planting in southwestern Indiana and Ohio having a rough go, that's kind of where that number showed. Those reactions was the harvested acre went down, but beans, they did a little adjustment there. They lost about 200,000 harvested acres as of right now. So I think you saw those numbers come off of that acreage report of saying, hey, we've still got quite a bit of acres to get planted up to this date. And I think we're seeing some of that factored into those harvested acre numbers.
It sure feels like it's around southern Indiana, because it has been a tough one. And, you know, we're still here. It is do a timestamp, and we're kind of mid-July timeframe, and we are still dumping soybeans. Dumping soybeans means that the beans didn't get planted or didn't get as much as we thought planted. And then we're hauling them off to your place and others. And so it's just been a tough year. Been trying to plant the crop for 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you can kind of see that so we've got two crops still going here. We've got old crop scenarios for the 24-25, and then we've got our new crop 25-26. And so the usage number was something that we, you know, the market was kind of trying to figure out what direction this stuff was going to go on the demand side for corn and beans. Corn, you saw the feed, seed, and that stuff, and the residual. We felt like the feed number probably was going to come down, mainly because of the cattle herd being at a historic levels as far as low, things like that. So for this old crop, the July report said, you know, they knocked 75 million bushels off of that number. So that's not helpful for prices. But what they did do is they upped the corn export number 100 million bushels. So net, we still saw a reduction in ending stocks for this old crop, which is helpful for prices. So that wasn't all bad to see that. We felt like that export number definitely should go up. I mean, we were running ahead of the USDA pace to meet it. The inspections were actually happening. So everything's looking like we're going to hit that number plus some. So that was nice to see that revision upwards. We felt like the feed number was going to come down, but you know, it was a big question mark as to how much, if they were going to make a change, if they're going to take kind of staggered steps at that. They did lower that. And they also did it for, so with those numbers factored in, right, the total beginning stocks and production, because of that 600,000 acre loss on the harvested number, and because the ending stocks being lower on the old crop corn, we're seeing total production and the carry-in stocks being lower than what they were projecting earlier in the year. So that was helpful. We did see feed get lowered for new crop usage as well, though, 50 million bushels. So net out of all of it, there was a lot of stuff there. We saw new crop ending stocks get lowered 90 million bushels.
Yeah.
So that's not bad. We're at 10%, a little 10.7% stocks to use rate. So corn's just kind of sitting there feeling like we got enough. We're okay. It's not crazy.
No urgency at all.
No, not really. It's not like we have overly burdensome. I think the big thing is that South America just had a phenomenal second crop. That Brazil Safrina corn was, they just kept bumping that number up higher and higher and higher. And that's a direct competitor for exports, right? So we saw that. Beans have been kind of quiet here lately as far as what the expectations. It just feels like the world has a lot of beans and the U.S. production is just kind of like, eh. That's what it just feels. Yeah. Now, when that EPA announcement came out and said, hey, you know, we're going to up the usage of the biomass diesel. We're going to cut out unverified cooking oil or even verified cooking oil from importing it. They're not going to qualify for tax credits. It's got to be domestic use. That was a shot in the arm to the bean market. So, and they reacted to that.
So say a little bit about that, because you kind of sent a note out last week about, or maybe it was a week before last, actually, the 45Z. Can you explain a little bit about what that is and why that's important?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not an expert on it. I'm still trying to figure out what's going on there. But what I found interesting was, you know, there's all this politicizing the big, beautiful bill or the bill, whatever you want to call it, whatever side of the aisle you fall on, ugly or beautiful.
Yeah,
I don't
whatever.
Care. It went through, right? And so a lot of green stuff kind of got the axe on it. But the 45Z tax credit stayed in there from what I'm reading and can see there. So that was beneficial. And that's the tax credit for like your carbon intensity score.
For the biofuel now, producers.
Yeah, for the biofuel. Yeah, so like ethanol is going to figure it out. You know, ethanol's in this, biodiesel's in it. So you've got the EPA saying, no, we're going to expect to use more biomass, you know, oil, basically soybean oil, palm oil, canola, stuff like that. We're going to expect to use more of it into we're going to blend it more in diesel. And with this 45Z tax credit, that means like some of these big headline news that we heard couple years ago about all these soy processors and things like that, it's going to be a big shot in the arm. That's where this thing's coming in at. So the more they blend, the more tax credits they're available to get to offset some of the other things. Now, the question is, how do they pass that through? They're going to have to prove their carbon intensity score. So it comes back to how we farm, you know, whether that's anything that we can do to be considered regenerative ag, it's going to lower that score. So the lower the score, the more appetizing you are or your bushels are to these end users, to these processors. So,
and that is US.
How much gets passed through and all that, I have no idea. I don't know what that looks like. I'm sure everybody's eventually going to come to some kind of consensus, but we'll see. I did one interesting thing that I read one time about it was some of these processors, whether that's an ethanol facility, a soybean facility, it doesn't matter. Some of them they may already have a CI score that's either so far gone or so low, they may not have as much incentive.
There's no
so
room.
They may not. Yeah, they may that low that certain one may not pass through as much as another location that sees a benefit coming in. And a lot of that's probably going to come from the aggregate of how the farms in that location go, right? If they've been early adopters, no-till, cover crops, just all that spot and spray, all those things probably come into it. If the county average is already so low, it may just be like, well, I don't feel like I have to pay as much because I'm going to get the average that is going to come in here is already low enough. I can't do much else above that. So I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what it does to my pipeline and what it looks like kind of, okay, what's the direction that these end users are going to take? You know, how much are they going to give? How are they going to document this stuff? That way I can figure out, you know, from your local co-op perspective, how do I pass that through to our local guys to still give the local destination instead of making them drive so far and cut down on how many bushels they can actually move in a week or a day? How do we pass that through and still provide value and just keep moving?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another thing that was in there was North American only, North American feedstocks only. So that was another good. Mm-hmm. And I kind of also wondered, we're in this land of tariffs now, you know, if those things may come back into play and be a positive factor at some point. So whether it's, you know, at one point, I think we were bringing in ethanol from other countries, you know, importing from Brazil and stuff. And maybe this will change some of that. We'll find out.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was the biggest takeaway that I took from that EPA announcement on the biomass diesel was that instead of relying so heavily on exports for beans, I mean, crush has been phenomenal, right? I mean, last couple of years, that's exports were holding steady. Crush was improving. That's really what drove those bean prices up to the levels that they were, on top of the fact that Brazil kind of had a okay couple of years, not great like they usually do, just okay. And so we saw really high prices for that. Well, how do you fix a overly burdensome balance sheet? You have to figure out how to use it, or you have to drop the price so low that you move it out of your system to create another wave, you know, to get rid of it so you can start to rebuild. And that's when prices start to come back, is when you've gotten rid of enough or used enough. So that was a big takeaway that I took from it was, okay, maybe we're figuring out, and I think we even talked about this like 2 or 3 years ago on those podcasts of, if we can figure out this biodiesel, there's a chance that this could be like an ethanol moment for the corn market. I mean, remember how ethanol came in and all of a sudden corn just boom, took off like a light switch. Am I saying we're going to take off like a light, like jump $2-3 out of nowhere for these beans? No, but it makes us more insulated, right? As a nation to where we're saying, okay, well, we're using this for something else. So we can, you know, we can use more of what we're producing instead of relying on everybody else.
Have a consistent.
So when we've created a new avenue for it, all of a sudden you put more pressure on the global market too, of saying, okay, well, the U.S. beans are getting gobbled up for this. Now what do we do?
Yeah, you know, where do we go from here? Is a consistent domestic demand.
And, so.
Yep. We'll change gears a little bit. Tell us what you're doing today. What is sweeping bins for those that, for those folks that may not know what that's like?
I wish it was kind of like Mary Poppins with a little broom. You're just in there, you know. I wish it was like that. I really do. Sweeping is a very odd way of calling it. Sweeping, so brooms eventually get involved.
Eventually.
Eventually. But sweeping is where, so for those that don't even understand what an auger is basically a metal shaft with thin pieces of metal wrapped around it in a spiral look. And as it turns, it's stationary, but as it turns, that flighting is what they call it. It pulls it to the center point or to wherever you're trying to get it to. Well, when you're sweeping a bin, the most typical style is where you've basically got an auger that sits on top of the bin floor with the shield behind it. And that row, it's got a center pivot point right over the center well in the center of the bin. And it just slowly works its way around the bin and goes into and goes in a circle, right? And it pulls all the beans or corn or wheat, whatever you've got in the bin, to the center and back out of the bin, into your overheads or whatever, or onto the trucks, whatever you have set up. They've got some other ones now, which we've gotten a couple of them, and they are phenomenal. They call them day sweeps. I'm sure there's just some other names for them, but the idea was they took a drag, and by a drag, what I mean by that is there's paddles inside a rectangular galvanized or stainless steel trough, and they've got a chain on the paddles are attached to the chain, and they just go around in a circle, right? And as they go past, they pull the product out to the leg and up and into wherever you're going with it. And so they took that idea and they basically just cut off the bottom front of it and said, all right, we're going to put some wheels on the backside of this thing. We're going to push this thing around a circle just like the sweep does, but it's going to drag everything. And those things are, my gosh, leave like nothing in the bin. You hit a button and you just kind of look at it.
Not as dusty.
There's hardly any cleanup behind it at all. The old styles are, some of them are still phenomenal, but eventually you have to get back in there after it's done and sweep and push it to the center and get it out. But yeah, so as far as, you know, there are some caveats with them. It's not without some risk. So if you're getting into those bins and sweeping, especially in the summertime with the heat, but anytime that you're getting in a bin, make sure somebody's watching.
Yeah, that's great. Right?
One person in, one person out at the door next to the control panel where they can kill it as soon as they have to. If you trip or if something goes wrong, they can hit that stop button as fast as they can. And, you know, in the summertime, bins get hot. And so make sure you take breaks. Get lots of water. I know the temptation is, well, I can get in there. I've done it 100 times. I can do it by myself. No big deal. Like, well, it's one more time. Well, yeah, you never know when that one more time is the last time. So just be mindful. Try to do the best. You know, we try to do the best we can here. We've always got somebody watching us. Everybody knows what's going on, where everybody's at. So there is safety involved in it. But yeah. It's not the funnest thing in the world. Now, those day sweeps, that's kind of one of those things where you put a lawn chair by the bin door out front. And you just kind of look inside while you sip your sweet tea and you're like, yep, it's still working. It's okay.
You had emailed, Aaron had emailed this morning and said what he was doing. And I was like, you need interns. And Aaron's like, I don't think they would last very long. They wouldn't come back.
Yeah, something about me. I talked to my ops guy too. He said, yeah, you sell. So just I get interns, he chuckled. And I said, I just don't see me going to the college campus and being like, hey, would you love to intern with us today, this summer? Like, she's like, okay, yeah, what would I be doing? Like, sweeping bins.
Yeah.
Sweeping bins. Like, but it's part of it, right? It's everybody has to do it.
Yeah.
So,
and it's a good safety message. That's a one in, one out. So,
hey, if there's any college students out there looking for it, by all means, call us. I can hook you up.
That's right. I can the hook experience, you up. Yeah. Character, building
it
character.
Is, yeah. Yep. It's all just right. One more piece in the logistical supply line that you're figuring out.
You got to know it. Aaron, thanks a lot. That's all I got. You got anything else for us?
I don't think so. A lot of guys are asking, a lot of girls and guys are just, everybody's just asking, where do we think these markets are going to go? And, you know, it's not really my job to figure out where these markets are going to go. And I hate to even look at it. I know locally, and I'm sure in Ohio and some of the other places that have struggled this year, this market feels like it's underpriced. It should be higher. But it's just one of those things where, sometimes when we look out our back door, we see the worst piece of it. And nationally, we look okay. And this is a weather market at this point. Weather's okay. Temps aren't absurdly hot. We're getting moisture throughout the countryside, some more than others, and some don't want any more.
Yeah.
You know, sadly, the Texas stuff's going on. I mean, that's horrible what happened down there. So prayers with those people. But this is one of those markets where if we kind of say, let's wait for a rally, maybe we lose 20 cents and then we see a rally of 10 cents. So net, we're still 10 cents lower than where we were at the day. And so this old crop situation, especially for corn, we're going to see that, you know, we've got local areas where the basis is really hot because the prices are not any good. So the end users are trying to pull what's out back in so they can use it. So the basis is doing its job and trying to move bushels from where they are to where they're not. But this one could be tough. We're running out of time. Yep. And so if you've got old crop out there, just be mindful, get in touch with people, try to figure out what you can do to take some of the risk off the table. It could bounce back up, but what if it doesn't?
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest question people need to think about is what if it doesn't? Or if it does, it could be in months down the road, that may not play well for an individual. So, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying anything that they don't already know, but sometimes it's nice to hear it again.
That's right. And I think with that, we'll close the books for another day and we'll see you on here. Maybe we'll have more of a positive outlook the next time. But that's one thing about farming is it's cyclical and it can go up and go down. But one thing we know, we need the bushels. And so every year we got to get as many bushels as we can. And that's what we're trying to do today is make the most out of what we have out there. So, yep. All right. Well, Aaron, thank you very much. And that's another episode of The High Ground powered by Premier Companies. Thank you very much.